Good morning and good afternoon, depending on where you're participating from. My name is Carlos Pachón. I'll be the moderator for this internet seminar on U.S. and EU perspectives on green and sustainable remediation. This is the part three. We call it part three because we have had two other webinars on this topic. First, leading up to CONSOIL last year, where we had a whole track on the topic. We then had a follow-up one there where we had an opportunity to hear what was said at CONSOIL and expand on some of the basic concepts. And this follow-up one, this third one, is a continuation of that series where we expect to provide some case studies on how green sustainable remediation efforts have been implemented, discuss EPA's draft environmental footprint methodology for estimating or quantifying a remediation site's footprint. We will also summarize information presented during a recent conference in Washington, D.C., which had a track on green and sustainable remediation. It was the International Committee on Contaminated Lands meeting in Washington. And then some key points from a common forum paper on sustainable and risk-informed land management. Finally, you will hear some updates from initiatives from around the world related to green and sustainable remediation. We have a lot of material to cover. What we're asking is that if you have a question for a speaker clarifying a specific topic, feel free to ask it once the speaker finishes, or you can, if you're participating by webcast, click on the question mark at any point, and I'll ask those specific questions immediately after the speaker finishes. Otherwise, if you have a more of a discussion question, we request that you hold it to the end. We have reserved a block of time so that we can have a conversation on the multiple topics we will be talking about. So for those of you participating on the phone, again, please remember to keep your phones on mute, except for when you want to ask a question, and avoid putting us on hold, as often corporations have streaming music when the phone puts on hold, and all of us on the phone line and on the internet will be hearing your company's music. For those of you on the internet, as I've mentioned, remember that on the top of the screen, we have the navigation button. Here's a question mark that opens up a little chat box, which I can see the question you type in. And as a moderator, I'll be taking those questions, as I mentioned earlier. If there's a specific clarification topic, I'll ask the speaker immediately after they finish. If it's a longer, more of a discussion question, I may hold it for the end of the speakers when we've reserved a block of time for that purpose to have a conversation. As you log in, you'll all see the agenda page. Please click on the bottom where it says go to seminar, and we should all be getting started on the first screen. First screen is a white screen with our cleanup information CLUIN logo on the top, and it's the welcome screen. This is the speakers. Again, I'll be moderating, and I'll be presenting one topic. After myself, you'll be hearing from Dietmar Müller of the Environment Agency in Austria. Third, after Dietmar, will be Paul Bartos with RQ Environmental Technology Limited from the United Kingdom. Kira Lynch, colleague of mine at EPA in the Seattle office in Region 10, will be presenting an EPA case study. And then we have Naomi Reagan from the National Grid Company in the UK as our final speaker. So for that agenda, please go to slide number two. Some housekeeping items. As I mentioned earlier, that's the navigation buttons you have across the top of your screen. The last button on the right allows you to save the PowerPoint or PDF. You get the option. PDF is a smaller file if you have bandwidth issues. The question mark button, you can ask a question at any point. And then the navigation buttons, Of course, go to slide one. I'll go to the last slide. But those two little forward and backward buttons are the ones I expect you'll be using the most. This event is being recorded, and it will be archived, so you will be able to listen to it again in about a week's time after today's webinar. Slide number three, please. Slide number four. Let's go straight to slide number four. I might have changed the order of the speakers. My first slide, this is the final one, so excuse any confusion there, but just to reiterate, it'll be myself talking about the EPA Environmental Footprint Evaluation Methodology, followed by Kira Lynch with an EPA case study, followed by Naomi Reagan from National Grid for the European case study, Dietmar Mueller with a debrief from the International Committee on Contaminated Lands, Green and Sustainable Track, followed by Paul Bartos, who has been collecting updates on international initiatives from the many organizations that have been on these webinars in the past. By the way, those webinars are archived, and if you'd like to, you can listen to them at any point. So with that, let me just check. I was missing one speaker, Paul Bartos. Have you joined us?
Yes.
Hi, Paul. Thank you. I got you. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started. On slide number five, it's the slide with the little pie chart with five pictures. Greener cleanups, EPA's methodology for understanding and reducing a project's environmental footprint. For those of you who participated in a webinar on August 10th, some of this material may be repetitive. I'm sorry if that's the case, but we did go ahead and release the draft methodology, so at least at this point, you'll actually get a chance to download it and take a look at it. Slide number six, please. So EPA Greener Cleanups Policy, I'll be very brief, as we have covered this in the past. Over 2 years ago, EPA released an overall program-wide, for all cleanup programs, policy on greener cleanups. And basically, it's boiled down to the basics. It's that consistent with existing laws and regulations. It is OSWA policy that all cleanups will protect human health and the environment, comply with all applicable laws and regulations, consult with communities regarding response action impacts, and consider the five core elements as recommended in the principles for greener cleanups. So again, this last bullet is really the only addition, and actually there is some more information on what those core elements are, and that's what this methodology does as well. It expands on them further. But we can say that the establishment of the principles is really just an incremental improvement in the implementation of EPA's cleanup programs. By the way, OSWER is an acronym for Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. It's basically EPA's land office. So we go to slide number seven. Superfund is one of five major cleanup programs in the United States. Some are public, some are state, some are other federal agencies, some are mostly in the private sector. But Superfund is definitely one of the more centralized ones, run mostly out of EPA offices and headquarters and the regions. And almost concurrent with the release of this OSWER policy, Superfund released a strategy for implementing the policy. It's basically Superfund's green remediation strategy. Its main aim is to reduce the demand placed on the environment during cleanup actions and conserve natural resources. The strategy specifies 40 actions that are being undertaken by the Superfund program to implement green remediation measures within the CERCLA and NCP frameworks, which are the law and regulations under which we operate. One of those actions is establishing a process for measuring improvements to environmental outcomes of Superfund cleanups, and that is what this methodology is. After 2 years of work, across programs. This is not unique to program, to the Superfund program. We're finally able to release the environmental footprint analysis methodology. With that, if you go to slide number 8, please. An important point for Superfund and for all programs is that the footprint analysis is not required at any of our sites. But as we've said in the past, you can't measure, you can't manage what you don't measure. Three key steps are evaluating the environmental effects of remedy implementation. To do that, we first develop the metrics associated with the 5-core elements, which are part of this methodology. And the methodology itself is used for quantifying those metrics, i.e. the environmental footprint. And finally, we apply the methodology during remedy design, implementation, operation, maintenance, and optimization. In the sense we seek to apply the Pareto principle here, we're seeking to take 20% of the actions that will help us achieve 80% of the footprint reduction. And our goal in developing this methodology was to identify the most significant contributors to the environmental footprint, to avoid chasing down every last NOx molecule, but to invest our resources where we'll have the greatest footprint reduction. Slide number 9, please. So the following two slides are the draft metrics that we released with the footprint methodology to quantify environmental footprints of cleanup projects. These metrics are program neutral, and we'll expand on them shortly, particularly in some of the in the case study coming up. But we certainly look forward to hearing from your thoughts during this discussion and any subsequent written feedback or comments you wish to submit to us. At the end of my talk here in just a couple of minutes, I'll give you the URL where you can download the draft methodology and submit any questions. So we rolled up the green remediation metrics, the footprint measures into a few upper-level numbers. Energy, the total energy used, and the percent of energy from renewable resources. Air, greenhouse gases, and criteria pollutants, nitrogen oxides, SOx, and particulate matter, both on-site emissions and total emissions. We also looked at hazardous air pollutants, both on-site emissions and total emissions. With respect to water, we look at on-site water use, including public potable water, its quantity, the source of that water, and the fate of the water. We also look at off-site water use and water table drawdown. If you go to slide number 10, please. Regarding materials and waste, this is often one of the more complex ones, and one of the reasons why it's important to be have a systematic approach to an environmental footprint, because data collection itself can be a very expensive process. But we think we found some good ways of streamlining this in the methodology. So regarding materials and waste, we look at manufactured materials used on site, the quantity and the percent from recycled materials, the bulk unrefined materials used on site, the quantity and percent from recycled materials, then waste, hazardous waste generated on site, non-hazardous waste generated on site, and the percent of total potential waste generated on site that is recycled or reused. The final core element is one for which we have not yet developed metrics. Overall, we look at the creation and protection of valuable ecosystem services, such as soil erosion control, nutrient uptake, etc. This is a core element for which we are still working on developing measures. In fact, there's a webinar tomorrow on one of the topics related to greenhouse gas capture and sequestration as part of site cleanup. So let's go to the next slide, please. Slide number 11, the methodology applicability. As I mentioned earlier, the methodology, process, and results are value for all types of cleanup projects in all cleanup programs in the U.S. and throughout a cleanup project. This is not something that need only be applied in the remedy selection, design, or construction phases. It can be applied at any point in time. Question we often get is, how will EPA use the methodology? Well, with respect to the Superfund program, we will and are and have been educating our remedial project managers and technical staff on working with the methodology, quantifying footprints, and taking actions to reduce the footprint. We'll conduct the footprint analysis at our own sites where and when appropriate. And we'll evaluate footprint analysis submittals to EPA by other parties based on or following this methodology. Go to slide number 12, a couple of points of clarification. Another question we often get is, does the footprint methodology call for life cycle assessment? In a sense, it calculates the green remediation metrics in a way similar to an LCA, but it does not apply an impact assessment as would be required by a full LCA. Another point is that materials and waste targets the on-site use and generation, does not look at other components that may be looked at in a full LCA, particularly upstream components. Energy, emissions, and water do have a fairly broad system boundaries, and since there might be more parallels there. Another question we often get is, does the methodology consider economic and societal factors? The footprint methodology focuses on the environmental footprint, those five core elements we talked about earlier. In the case of the Superfund program, societal and economic factors, the classic triple bottom line, are currently being addressed in the program through existing processes such as community involvement requirements and EPA Superfund redevelopment initiative. We believe that those two pillars of sustainability are currently being addressed. Where we had a vacuum was in identifying the environmental footprint of a cleanup, and hence the development of the policy, of the principles, the Superfund strategy, and this footprint evaluation methodology. So if we go to slide number 13, these are the six steps we'll be talking about, but for the sake of time, we'll go straight to slide number 14. And as I mentioned earlier, we welcome feedback on the draft methodology, which is available online at this URL here, cluin.org/green remediation. And with that, I'll hand it over to our next speaker, Keira Lynch.
Thanks, Carlos. So going on to slide number 15, as Carlos said, I am a remedial project manager, or I was a remedial project manager. I'm now the representative in Region 10 for the Office of Research and Development for a site where we applied the green remediation methodology that Carlos has just spoken with you about. Going on to slide number 16. This is a site that is in Tacoma, Washington, and it is a Superfund site. Going on to slide number 17. So this is a site where the main contaminants of concern are chlorinated solvents, and the Environmental Protection Agency had identified a drinking water supply well that had been contaminated, and what they identified was a long dissolved phase plume about 3,000 feet that was coming from the old Time Oil property, which was a property where they had been doing waste oil reprocessing and oil canning. And we did identify that we had both a light non-aqueous phase liquid and a dense non-aqueous phase liquid within the actual source area itself. going on to slide number 19. So what we did with this site is that we identified the technologies that would be used for going in and evaluating the source area itself. And what was identified there was a multi-component design, so we were going to have various pieces of remediation that would be fit together. This offered a unique opportunity from the standpoint of applying the information that we got from the methodology, because we could optimize and combine the various technologies in ways that took into consideration what the ultimate impact was on the environment, and be able to really look at how do we reduce the demand placed on the environment by the way that we combine the technologies. So what we were looking at there is we had a combination of going in and excavating some of the more near surface contaminated soils. We were also looking at use of in situ thermal remediation. So this was like electrical resistive heating to treat the product material in the deep beta zone and the upper saturated zone. We are also considering the use of enhanced anaerobic bioremediation for some of the higher concentration groundwater, and also utilizing the existing groundwater extraction and treatment system, which is a pump and treat system that treats the water via carbon treatment. Going on to slide number 20, part of the other components of this design for the larger dissolved phase plume is that we were also utilizing the enhanced anaerobic bioremediation for that area, and we also have well treatment that was put into place at the actual wellhead that was being used for the public water supply well. So going on to slide number 21, this was a site that actually had our cleanup decision, which is documented in a record of decision that had been put in place in the early 90s. So what we were looking at in 2009 is what was an amendment to that record of decision to really go and focus in on the source area treatment. So this record of decision amendment came out after the EPA Office of Solid Waste Policy that Carlos spoke about. So we were able to actually insert it, the consideration of this, into the record of decision so that it became a key component of what we were looking at as far as the cleanup strategy. And consistent with what Carlos had pointed out, the key here is that it wasn't put in as a decision criteria as much as a balancing criteria to say, you know, we need to ultimately have a remedy that will be protective of human health and the environment, but to the extent that we can, we want to use best engineering practices to reduce the demand placed on the environment based on the way that we apply the technologies. Going on to slide number 22. So we went through a process of evaluating the various pieces of the remedy with the footprint methodology that had been developed. And the idea is that we were going to identify the contributors that were the largest contributors to the overall footprint and look at options for being able to modify the way that we're designing the remedy to reduce those footprint impacts. So going on to slide number 23, this what you can see here is the metrics on the left-hand side, and you can see the various components along the top. We have the excavation piece. We have the in-situ thermal and the enhanced aerobic bioremediation and the groundwater extraction and treatment. and you can see which pieces of the design had the biggest impact on the majority of metrics. And you can see here that definitely excavation had a very large footprint. Going on to slide number 24, as I said previously, the excavation and off-site disposal was determined to have the greatest footprint. One of the things that I thought was an interesting output of this is that many people would think that using electrical heating would really have a very big energy-intensive footprint, but because the majority of energy within the Tacoma grid system is supplied by hydroelectric and nuclear sources, it had a lower environmental footprint than what most of us expected to see there. So going on to slide number 25. So based on the output of the methodology, we went back and we looked at the design for the source area remediation, and we looked at opportunities to try to be able to reduce that footprint. So one of the things that we did is because we were going to be applying the in-situ thermal within the same area that we were doing excavation, we modified the depth for excavation proposed and increased the area over which we were going to do the in-situ thermal remediation. So that's just an example of when you have a multi-component design like this, how you can optimize the way that you're combining those technologies to take into consideration the green remediation aspects. Going on to slide number 26. So some of the other outputs that we had going forward with the excavation design is that we also specified some things in regards to the transportation and disposal component of the excavation to be able to reduce the footprint there. So some of the things that we did is we specified a preference for local borough sources and disposal facilities. We also identified that the concrete was to be segregated and recycled locally. We pre-characterized the soil to be able to minimize the transportation for landfill disposal. And we also required that the selected facility generate energy from the treatment process, which goes back into the grid, and required that the contractor also identify for us what transportation method they were going to use and be able to specify for us how they had taken into consideration what the footprint impact was going to be on that transportation analysis. So you can see here that many of these things that came out of the methodology are really just best engineering practices that we then carried forward into the specifications that we put together for contracting the remedial action at the site. Going on to slide number 27, some of the other component of the excavation design that we looked at was the specifications on the diesel emissions, and we put in there things like a no idling policy for vehicles, requiring the contractor to use cleaner engines, and also to track the emissions associated with the diesel equipment used on site during the remedial action. Going on to slide number 28. So some of the other components that we also looked at as a result of the output from the methodology is that we did identify that the more that we could refine the area that we were focusing on for treatment, the reduced footprint that we would have. So we have used a process of kind of continual update of the conceptual site model to be able to refine and look at the boundaries of where we really need to target for the source area treatment. We also have looked at the fact that we needed within the specifications, in many cases, our contracting office would not allow us to specify, for example, that the contractor would have to go to a particular facility because it was closer by. So we needed to develop ways to be able to require the contractor to still have the flexibility to select, for example, what disposal facility they wanted to use, but at the same time justify for us how in the selection of that facility they had taken into consideration the potential footprint impacts based on the distance and other factors associated with transportation for the waste to that facility. And then finally, one of the other aspects that we're currently evaluating is we're evaluating various off-spec or waste product enhancements for the bioremediation nutrient as opposed to using a primary source for that. So going on to slide number 29, that's the end of my case study.
Thank you very much, Kira. Appreciate it. There are a few questions for you. Some of them are very specific, so I'm going to go ahead and ask them now, and then there are some others that I will state later. The first one is from Michael Mueller in Adventist Europe in Innsbruck, Austria. His question is, what is the anaerobic biotechnology considered at the Tacoma site? ZBI, plus carbon, in situ, chemical reduction, et cetera?
It is basically just adding a food source for the natural anaerobic bioremediation that was happening. So we're looking at, you know, adding vegetable oil or other off-spec food sources to basically enhance the natural attenuation that has been ongoing at the site, but basically stalled out because of a lack of carbon.
Okay, thank you. Another one. Let's see. Daniel Susanni and Environ, Milano, Italy. On slide 23, which calculation tool was used?
On slide 23, the calculations that were used, I think that's the table that shows the footprint. So those are the calculations out of EPA's footprint methodology that was used to populate that table. That's the methodology that is available on the website that Carlos showed at the end of his presentation.
Okay, and finally one from Paul Nathaniel in Nottingham. There's the United States, but I think he's with the UK. But anyway, slide 23. Similar but different. Why is energy and CO2 and electricity counted? How do we avoid double counting?
Sorry, Carlos, you broke up there, so I didn't hear the whole question.
Yeah, the question is on the table on page 23, we include energy, we include CO2, we include local electricity. The question is, how do you avoid double counting, and how do we avoid double counting in the methodology?
I think that the way that this has been set out, that it actually is not double counting, but that is probably a better question for Doug Sutton, who I do not think is on.
No, he's not on, but it's basically, Paul, the idea is that there is, at some sites we may use energy which has a zero CO2 footprint. So it's important to know what the total energy is, what the total CO2 footprint is, and where the electricity comes from. So those are independent parameters, but it is structured to avoid counting. And I do invite a review of the methodology to help us ensure that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we are double counting. There are a few more questions, but I think there are more discussion questions of the nature of this one. So if it's okay, I'll everybody please move on to slide 29. And I'll hand it over to Naomi. Naomi, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much, Carlos. And sure. Thanks for the opportunity to present. I work for National Grid Property in the UK, in the commercial property team. We essentially have a remit to deal with our surplus legacy of former gaswork sites. I'm just going to go straight on to slide 30. The presentation today is really going to briefly give an introduction to National Grid, a quick recap of SURF UK, which I understand has been the subject of a previous presentation, so I'm really going to skip through that quickly, and then an overview of a couple of examples to illustrate the direction that National Grid is taking in implementing that framework and how we're aligning the framework to what we do. Now, I'll have a quick apology in advance that if anybody was at the Brownfield Remediation Conference, this is a very similar presentation to the one that I gave there. So I know Paul, for example, this will be quite similar. But if we just go straight on now then to slide 31, as an initial introduction to National Grid, we are an international electricity and gas company. We are one of the largest investor-owned energy companies in the world, and we have a company vision and strategy that's underpinned by targets to focus on sustainability in every part of the business. So essentially our ambition is to have sustainability embedded into everything that we do. And National Grid Property within National Grid is the team that's responsible for, as I said, the management of our portfolio of former gaswork sites, of which there are many across the country. I'm just going to go quickly to slide 32. Just as a quick recap, the definition of sustainable development that we work to is obviously that set out in the Brundtland Report, which conventionally defines the three components of environmental, social, and economic factors. And sustainable remediation is the application of those principles of sustainable development to risk-based contaminated land management. And really that the key is the demonstration of net benefit. So as a quick skim through and a reminder of some of the key figures, I've just moved to slide 33. Some of the key figures from the SURF UK framework, which I understand, as I said, has been presented previously. The framework sets out two key stages. It identifies a stage A, which is the project planning and design stage, where you have the chance to embed sustainability into the design of the project, and a stage B, in which you have the option to embed sustainability into the remediation implementation. The hash line between the two is normally a fixed milestone that when you transition from one to the other, you can't go back to either the signing of a contract to a particular design. And obviously the biggest gain that you can make is in stage A, where you can consider sustainability in your designing of your project. And just on to 34. The other key figure from the SURF UK framework is the one that shows that the process really and encourages a tiered approach. It encourages you to consider your criteria at the start and then go through a tiered approach to your assessment. And that the key important factors are that the process does need to be usable and the decisions need to be transparent. So that's just a very quick recap on the SURF UK framework, and I'm now going to start to move on to how National Grid's implementing it. So I'm moving on to slide 35. So why is sustainable remediation important to National Grid? We have a legacy, and our predecessors, we don't have the luxury of our predecessors sort of working within the guidelines of the Brundtland Report, and we have a past land use that wasn't sustainable. What we have to do is tackle that legacy and really deal with correcting the past activity. And remediation itself creates an impact. So what we have to do is work within that to make sustainable decisions within dealing with the remediation of former gasworks. And what's critical is that we can demonstrate a net benefit and that we can show balanced, transparent decision-making throughout. So now I'm just going to take you through, moving to slide 36. I'm going to take you through two examples, which hopefully help to illustrate the way that National Grid is exploring the use of an application of the framework to our sites, and really the direction that we've started to take. So the first example is a full, detailed, semi-quantitative sustainability assessment that was carried out retrospectively for National Grid's first commercial scale cluster project. And then what this led us to was obviously to learn some lessons, to change direction in our approach, and it really emphasized the need to consider sustainability holistically. And so where we're moving to now is really a process to embed sustainability into every aspect of what we do and look at it more holistically. So moving to slide 37, this is a picture of a site in Partington in northwest England, where we completed a cluster project using Clare's Code of Practice, which is a framework which allows for the reuse and movement of materials. I've listed some of the key benefits that we achieved from actually using the cluster approach, but in terms of the detail, I could give a whole presentation in itself on how we carried out a retrospective sustainability assessment on this site. I'm purposely not going to go into that detail because we are currently writing up a case study looking at exactly what went into it and exactly all of the decisions that were made and how we applied them. But the key thing I want to bring out here is the lessons that we learned and how we're applying them to our view of sustainability. So, due to the complexity of this site, you know, there's quite a lot of detail gone into this, and I'll just emphasize again that I will add the link at the end, and there'll be a full case study which will go into the detail. So I'm just going to go to slide 38. Our approach at the outset for this sustainability assessment was, because it was such a complex project, there was four remediations that were carried out simultaneously, interacting with each other and utilizing a central hub to remediate the materials. Because it was such a complex project, we took the view that we needed quite a complex, semi-quantitative sustainability assessment. And the process that we followed was to consider each of the 18 SURF UK indicators. Now, they are detailed within the framework, but essentially just as a quick recap, SURF UK pull together indicators which are all relevant to the industry and benchmarked them and created a list of six environmental indicators, six key social indicators, and six key economic indicators that were recommended to be used and to be considered when carrying out assessments. We used each of those 18 indicators and developed sub-indicators that were relevant to the project. So for the one highlighted on the screen, for example, this is one of the six under the environmental category, impacts on ecology. We developed three sub-indicators within this to consider. And just moving on to slide 39, our approach to the assessment was to take each of the options that we had for the four sites, to use the indicators from the SURF UK framework, and to look at each of the options from the viewpoint of the stakeholders. And just moving to slide 40. The next two slides, this one and the next slide, present some of the ways that the findings can be shown. This slide, slide 40, shows you for one site, for one of the four, the option that was preferred for each of the five stakeholders that we considered against all of the environmental, social, and economic options and issues. And as you can see, what it demonstrates is the difference, which you would expect, in views of a preferred option. So whereas a landowner and the regulators, when you plug all the numbers in, actually the treatment at the cluster, because of the recognition that this treatment has to happen, the treatment at the cluster came out as the preferred. But the neighbour and the local business, actually doing nothing, was more of a preferred option. And slide 41, this just shows you a different way of presenting the information. And it shows each of the four sites, so site A, B, C, and D, the total score against all of the stakeholders and all of the indicators considered, to show you which came out as the preferred option. And as you can see, for site A, B, and C, actually treatment at the cluster was the preferred option, and for site D was actually in situ remediation. And I think that's kind of one of the realities, really, that site D was the one that actually was the biggest site, had the biggest volume of material to feed into the cluster, but was needed to be part of the cluster to give it that viability to work. So that's a whistle stop. That's a really quick run through that Partington assessment. Now, as I said, a case study that goes into the detail of how all those numbers and scorings were built up is in production, and I can give the link to the Surf UK website, which will detail that. I'm just going to go on to slide 42. So where did running through this process for a complex site take us in our understanding and our consideration of sustainability? Well, it gave us the ability to test the Surf UK framework and apply it to some real sites. It also gave us the ability to consider all the aspects of the cluster and look at potential areas of gain for future projects that we would carry out. And it gave us a mechanism, albeit in this case retrospective, a mechanism to test from the viewpoint of the stakeholders. However, when we considered it from our own, across our whole portfolio, it was apparent that it was too complex for every project. It was emphasized to us that the need to really go back to basics and consider sustainability at the most simple form, and it reiterated the belief that it should be factored into every decision, and that the key point is that decisions should be transparent at whatever level they're taken. So just move into slide 43. The approach that we're currently looking at is one of developing some key, what we're terming minimum standards, to set a benchmark at a qualitative level. So what do I mean by this? A minimum standard will be a predetermined standard for each indicator, which will define the impact or minimum benefit that National Grid will accept or seek to deliver. A non-achievement will not, you know, completely rule out an option, but it will lead to further assessment and potential elimination of options. And along with these minimum standards, we're looking to develop some aspirational targets, which are one step higher, predetermined target for each indicator, which we hope will drive improvements. So I'm just going to illustrate that on slide 44. And how this will work in practice. So, for example, I've shown here one sub-indicator of ecology. So going back to where we looked at previously, there were six key headline indicators within the environmental factors. And for one of those, which is ecology, I've developed one sub-indicator here, which is for invasive species. And given an example of what a potential minimum standard might be, and that could be something along the lines of works will not cause the spreading of invasive species, and a potential aspirational target will relate to eradication of those species on site. The process will really be predetermining our minimum standards against the indicators, running through and assessing feasible options against them. And where an option doesn't deliver a minimum standard, to consider those indicators in more detail. So if we just move on to slide 45, what this approach creates is really, we hope, a simple early opportunity to demonstrate sustainability, a framework to eliminate options and identify where you need more information, a process to build up the detail of assessments as appropriate, and a process to ensure that effort is spent on the most contentious decisions. So where options actually completely meet minimum standards and pass, then it's the ones that don't that you then take to another tier, another level, and spend more time looking at, not the whole list of them. It's a process for clear and structured, transparent decision making, and a process to enable early engagement with stakeholders. And really, it's also a tool that allows, you know, once produced and communicated, allows the commitment to sustainability to be made clear at all levels. So just kind of finishing off with the last couple of slides, if we move to slide 46. As a reminder, the Surf UK framework encourages a tiered approach, but I think the key thing here is it doesn't ask you to choose just one tier to go through. So it doesn't ask you to choose at the outset which level of detail, which stage tier approach you would take. It really emphasizes that you start at the simplest level, and wherever possible, decisions should be based on the most simple sustainability assessment, and then move on with those more contentious decisions in an iterative way. In slide 47, this slide just links the way I would believe this process works in a similar way to the established process for risk assessment, and there are many similarities there, i.e. the process is built up in terms of complexity as the number of pollutant linkages reduces, and here as the number of options or indicators reduces, and allows for extra effort where it's proportionate to put it. So next slide, 48. The next step for National Grid are to really fully develop these minimum standards and aspirational targets, to test them with a number of sites and stakeholders, and then to look at what the next tiers would look like. So if an indicator didn't meet a minimum standard, an option didn't meet a minimum standard, what will be the next stage for that to be passed through? And just on to slide 49 in conclusion, we work to use the Surf UK framework in the UK. It allows for transparency and recording of decisions. And the key thing for National Grid, I think, that we've taken from this piece of work is that sustainability assessments don't need to be overly complex. The most important thing is to embed sustainability into decision making, and the same level of effort is not necessarily needed for all decisions. It's the focused effort that's important. And more often than not, it's no more than is being done already when someone completes an options appraisal and thinks through things in their head. It's just a logical process to work through that allows the decisions to be transparent. Slide 50 is, and the next slide as well, just a couple of thanks. This is just thanks to the Surf UK steering group. Obviously, Paul Bardos as well, recognised as part of the steering group, and slide 51, just recognition of some of the suppliers who've been involved in both the sustainability assessment, this wider work that we're doing, and the cluster project itself. And just finally, slide 52 is to finish off with the Surf UK framework and the regulatory approval that it's received. And that's Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Naomi. Appreciate your presentation, taking the time to appear and deliver. And I enjoyed listening as a whole. I'd heard little bits and pieces of it, so it's great to hear the whole thing. There are a few questions for you. Let's see if I can select some of the ones that are you might be able to answer in less time. First one here from Diana Hassigan of Langan Engineering and Environmental Services Warranty in Pennsylvania. Sorry if I butchered your name, Diana. The question is for slide 4041. Can you go into a little bit more detail about how the metrics were computed, aggregated, and how factors weighted in?
Yeah, I can do. I suppose I know I appreciate that I didn't go into much detail, and I suppose that because of the time that we had, I was keen to be able to go through the different options and how sort of the different assessments that we've done. Just as a kind of a broad outline, essentially we took a number of different sub-indicators and gave them a score. So if you consider, for example, you know, emissions from a project, you might have a score of between 1 and 5, depending on how great the emissions would be. That's just, you know, a broad example. And so those are preset scores. You then see where your options sat, what emissions would result from that particular option, and score it. And then for the input of the stakeholders, that added a weighting. So what you would look at is for each of those indicators, so again, consider potentially emissions, how important that indicator might be to those various stakeholders. So, you know, we used a score of between 0 and 1. You know, it's just whatever sort of number to build up the importance. And then when you add the score and the importance by the stakeholder, you get an overall kind of score for that option against that indicator, and then you can kind of aggregate those together. Now, I hope I've explained that clearly enough, and as I said, we will go into quite a lot of detail in the case study as to how that's been built up.
Okay, thank you. Another question from Arpo Panconi in Ispra in Rome. National Grid has implemented this approach on a voluntary basis? Question.
The approach to the sustainability assessment?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we carry out a voluntary program of remediation as well, and I think you know, it's important to us to be considered. It's important to us to be sustainable as part of the bigger, wider National Grid remit in terms of being an energy company. It sits within that, obviously. For National Grid property, it's important for us to also align to that. But I think if you go back to why companies consider, you know, why companies should be sustainable, it relates to key things such as, you know, the regulatory drivers, you know, economic drivers as well. But also in terms of corporate drivers for big companies, our brand reputation and our sort of the reputation that you get from making decisions transparent and making sustainable decisions. So absolutely, it's a voluntary thing.
Thank you, Naomi. Thanks again for the presentation. We have two more speakers, and we're hoping that we can wrap up presentations at half past, so if it's okay, I'm going to move on to the next speaker. Thank you, Naomi. So everybody, please go to slide 53, and I'll hand it over to Dietmar Mueller of the Environment Agency Austria in Vienna. Dietmar?
Thanks, Carlos. Hi from Vienna. Well, I've been selected to report on the last meeting of the International Committee on Contaminated Land, which also contained a track on green and sustainable remediation. So moving on to slide 54, you see there have been four thematic sessions, and the first session, session A, was about integrating contaminated site remediation and reuse strategies. So that's what goes in the direction of green and sustainable sustainability. I will do a brief twilight for all the six talks we had in the morning, and then come back for my talk, the first discussions we are having at the Common Forum on Contaminated Land in Europe. And then the afternoon of the meeting was a breakout session, and I will briefly also introduce the highlights of this discussion. So moving on to slide 55, what I was going on was, well, introducing again the International Risk Governance Council framework, which is a really inclusive framework on risk and risk management. And then I tried what I will come back later to think about risk management and sustainability, where the differences are and where complementarity might be met. I was followed by Anja Sinke and Co. Molinar from Nicole and the Dutch Ministry of Environment, just exercising on how industries and the regulator may work together, showing up the challenges, ensuring the maintenance of institutional controls for cleanups in urban environments. So there are new concepts in the Netherlands to how to share responsibility and liability. There is kind of a different thinking, so the soil and the site staying within the responsibility of the site owner, whereas the responsibility for plumes and groundwater might be handed over to an organization or to the regulator. Finally, they ended up by a case study in heat pumps as used as a part of a site reuse and remedy enhancement. Then we moved back by presentation to Quebec, Canada. So Quebec, there is a new soil policy. Michel Bourdieu introduced this policy by its four components, which are heading to three goals. So it's all what we know about protecting human health and environment, to do it in a sustainable way, and on participation, informing all players. There are different parts in this strategy. You may read it, and it ends up the new policy discussing 8 intervention strategies and 35 kinds of actions. After break, we heard Peter Nadebaum from Australia. So his talk was entitled "Do Australian Cleanup Projects Currently Accord with the Concept of Sustainable Remediation?" And his conclusions were that, well, regulations are flexible along site-specific remedy endpoints, so that's what's something necessary on sustainability. Land use considerations are allowed, and they are seeking down under also the balance in sort in environmental, social, and economic considerations. Moving on to slide 57. It was back to Europe, Marijke Kadon from OVAN, which is the Flemish waste agency, more or less, introduced a revision of a Flemish multi-criteria tool, which is underway, and which aims to include sustainability issues. So they are looking for integrating life cycle analysis and a CO2 calculator. And like we have seen for the SURF UK, also the procedure should allow a tiered approach of qualification and quantification. Finally, we ended up the morning with Paul Nathaniel, representing Covernet, which is a brownfield network, and the University of Nottingham. He had an inspiring talk, conceptualizing with some thinking about start with the end in mind, so that's always about setting the objectives, where do we want to end up. He provided his 7 habits of effective regeneration, and finally suggested, because sustainable is a really, really often used term, to replace it by smart in terms of successful, measured, appropriate, respectful, and temporal. Also, I want to introduce, well, watch out for his presentation. All the presentations, all 6 presentations, will be available soon on the webpage of the International Committee of Contaminated Land. Moving on to slide 58, coming back to my talk, you see the kind of very simplified thinking, what's common, what's different in between risk and sustainability. So there are different backgrounds, whereas risk is more coming from the economy part and the science part. Sustainability for sure is more to the ecology part, to the policy part. You may see or understand risk as kind of a mental construct. You never know the future. Sustainability, well, that's an ethical construct. So, and it aims at fairness. Risk, the objective should be transparency. Probably both of these objectives count for risk and sustainability as well. So so the concepts may answer different questions. So risk is about should we act in terms of contaminated land, and sustainability is about how can we act. So what we're looking out for is better decisions and better action. That's something we could make complementary. The strategies in there, well, risk, the classic strategy is to prevent or to limit. Sustainability is looking out for synergies. Moving on to slide 59. What we need to do in Europe to make it complementary is about, well, we need new discussions at the European level for clarifying the objectives, system and system boundaries, principles, milestones along the land management process. So understanding risk prepares the judgment, sustainability prepares the management actions, and both together, risk and sustainability, need to control the implementation, the management, like Carlos has addressed before, you can't manage what you can't measure. What is also an important point is, well, we need to make it complementary, and there is not trading risks against sustainability. Moving on to slide 16, you see, well, the Common Forum intends to prepare kind of a discussion paper called a non-paper to provide a better understanding of our frames, to prepare better decisions. We have the conceptual frameworks out there, so we have a agreed framework of risk-based land management in Europe, some 10 years old. We have now frameworks on sustainability given by SURF UK and Nicole, and what we need is to amalgamate it to kind of a governance framework to integrate the both aspects. And we have also in Europe a lot of analytical tools already out there and metrics as well. I don't think I need to go into detail here. So moving on to slide 61, I'm coming back to the afternoon session of the meeting or the session A at the ICCL meeting. It was the first part to discuss about the current state of practice in the different countries and exchange views. So we are probably, in a lot of countries, we are still at the stage to build more awareness on the concepts of sustainability and site remediation reuse. We had some discussions on there, well, just one month ago, there was kind of a new policy paper in Europe, which is the roadmap on resource efficiency, providing some visions and targets to meet, like Europe by 2050 wants to have no net land consumption. You can compare it. Most of the member states in Europe have their own targets like that. What is still feels for practical aspects to, well, make decisions more transparent. That would allow the flexibility in remedy decisions. And it's all coming back to the most important is kind of a robust definition of objectives. Moving on to slide 62. The second question during the breakout session was about, well, the challenges for the future. I just want to point you to the last two bullets. So it's what probably most of the participants felt was that, well, we are in a rapidly evolving process discussing sustainability, but still there might be a kind of a gap in between to adapting quantitative approaches and comparing them. was it a lust bullet? Do we really achieve a shared vision of definitions, move to people, for example, who defines practicable and how to understand? Moving on to slide number 63. The last question at the breakout session was about, well, opportunities to address challenges in the future. So you see the four, well, major ideas about, well, we need to expand technical options to reduce cleanup footprints. We need to still learn from fellow peers, from each other, how to establish a quantitative approach to sustainability and come up with kind of a full suite of regulatory policy, incentive tools, whatever. So that's what I would call going to the direction of governance, sustainability governance, and environmental stewardship. Finally, also that's always about improving our processes in participation. Well, that was the report on the meeting held some 3 weeks ago in Washington, D.C. Moving on to slide 64, I just want to announce that the Environment Agency Austria and CARE from the UK are discussing to organize a conference on sustainable remediation by November 2012. So more information is to follow soon. We hope to have a first announcement during November. Personally, I hope this will be to Vienna. You see the picture of our museum. So we have the culture historically museum, the nature historically museum in the vicinity within our Empress in between. So it would be a pleasure to see you all in Vienna next year. That's it, Carlos.
Thank you very much, Dimar. I really appreciate the question. Let me just a quick clarification from Naomi's presentation. I have two questions from Pennsylvania and also from Paul Bardos asking if the case study will be summarized on the SURF UK website. The other question from Diana is whether there is a report available that talks about the details that you mentioned. Are you still with us, Amy?
I am, yes. Yes, the case study is in preparation. I think I've got the first draft of it just to go through, and then it'll just need to be signed off by the steering group, and then it'll go on to the SURF UK website. There isn't a report as such, but I can, you know, once the case study goes out, if it's Diana, if she wants to speak to me in more detail about any information that's not included in that, I'm more than happy to talk through those. But hopefully hopefully the case study will include enough information. You know, that's what our aim is, to get the detail of what we did out into that.
Thank you. And, of course, all the speakers' emails are on the front page. There's an typo in Paul Bardos's. It's dated. We're taking steps to correct it, hopefully briefly. But otherwise, everybody's email address, all the speakers are on the registration page. So thank you. We have a couple of questions here for Dietmar. I think they're more in the discussion in nature. Dietmar, so if it's okay, we'll hand it over to the next speaker and bring these up in the discussion part.
That's fine for me.
Okay. So if everybody will please click on to slide number 65. Paul, are you with us?
I am. How are you?
Okay. I'm fine, Paul. Thank you. So everybody, this is Paul Bardos from RQ Environmental Technology Limited in the UK. So what are yours, Paul?
Thank you, Carlos. Good morning or good afternoon, everybody. What Dietmar's forgotten to tell you about Vienna is it has the most wonderful coffee and cuisine, so I hope that we will have a conference there and you'll all be able to come to it. One of the activities we did in preparing this webinar was to ask the various international initiatives looking at sustainable and green remediation to give us an update slide of what they've been doing over the past 12 months. And we've collated these slides into the presentation that I'm going to run through. And you'll see that it's been a very active 12 months. So we'd like to move to the next slide, which is 66. basically, each initiative has provided one slide, and I'm going to go through them one by one. And I'll begin by pretending to be Dietmar and telling you a little bit about Eurodemo Plus. There's a new initiative that's been published by the European Commission in Europe, which was launched in January, which is called a Roadmap to Resource-Efficient Europe. And this is seen as a part of worldwide efforts to get a transition towards a greener economy. And this document sets out a whole range of overarching and sectoral visions across all areas of the economy to 2050 and sets some milestones and targets in the short term. And this includes land as a resource. So, in general, Eurodemo Plus sees this as a very welcome initiative, but some of the detail and some of the targets probably need a little bit of attention. For example, something that Eurodemo Plus welcomes is the idea that there should be no net land take by urban development after 2050. So we shouldn't be swallowing up any more countryside. We should be reusing our brownfield land more effectively. But one of the short-term targets that's been set is all about setting up inventories for contaminated land by 2015. Now, the whole issue of inventories is fraught with difficulty in Europe because member states tend to legislate for contaminated land in different ways. So it's very difficult to have comparable data across member states. And it's seen as, so I guess Eurodemo see this really as rather an old-fashioned idea, something that's been round the mill and been rejected as probably not being very helpful, rather than being a future-orientated vision like this idea of no net land take by 2050. In general, Eurodemo Plus is convinced that innovation and remediation technologies is vital in terms of making Europe more resource efficient with regard to land management. And they are aiming to contribute their ideas to sustainable remediation to help provide easily understandable indicators to measure progress towards this in Europe. And a couple of things that Eurodemo are particularly interested in, which are available in reports from their website, which is eurodemo.info, is the application of eco-efficiency, and in particular energy efficiency, as a measure for looking at improved performance for soil and groundwater remediation. And this vision of what they call Factor 4 technologies, is it possible to have remedial approaches which are half the cost and double the environmental benefit? I hope I've done reasonable justice to that, but luckily I think Dietmar's still on the line, so if I've got anything wrong, you can correct me in due course. Moving on to the next slide, which is 67. This is about the Sustainable Remediation Forum, which was started in the United States, which I guess is the granddaddy of similar forums right across the world now. This forum continues as a very live initiative for a broad range of sectoral interests in the application of sustainability concepts right across the life cycle of remediation projects from investigation to closure. Something that they've been doing more recently in 2011 is to try and diversify their stakeholder participation, particularly finding consensus with regulatory and academic interests. Recently, they've published in Remediation Journal a series of papers, their own sustainable remediation framework, an example of a life cycle analysis applied to remediation, and some tools for metrics for sustainable remediation. And these are also available from their website, which is sustainableremediation.org. their future plans are related to more specific technical initiatives to do with tools and decision support, student initiatives, and education initiatives. Moving on to slide 68, and that's Surf UK, which I take part in. You will know from Naomi's talk at least that Surf UK published a framework for assessing the sustainability of soil and groundwater in March 2010, and this has had wide regulatory acceptance in the UK, and also, I'm very happy to tell you, wide acceptance by user communities, and it's beginning to be used by a number of larger consultancies and land managers in the UK. And we hope that Surf UK will have some case studies about that in the not too distant future. Naomi presented some examples of indicators for assessing sustainable remediation. Surf UK is about to publish a report, which will probably be published in November, a short report, where we suggest 15 overarching categories of indicators which we think people can use to benchmark their own sustainability appraisals to see if it's appropriate and sufficiently wide-ranging. In addition to the case studies, which are currently being written up, there is already existing on the Surf UK website a series of frequently asked questions, and these are designed to help people to use the framework more easily. We're currently assessing our requirements for the next phase of work in the UK, a third phase of work, and I'm sure that if anybody's got any ideas or comments, we'd be delighted to hear them, and you can provide them to us through the Surf UK website. And the final thing I'd say about Surf UK is that all of its outputs are freely available from that website. Moving to the next slide, 69. Surf in the Netherlands is brand new. I'm very pleased that Hans Lenders and Laurent Bakker, who are some of the people behind this, have sent us a slide to describe it. It's a cross-sectoral initiative like Surf UK, including policy, regulators, service providers, problem holders. Something that's quite interesting about the approach in the Netherlands is they're always a bit ahead of the game, and their interest is not just in remediation, but in sustainable management of the subsurface for a range of uses. In the Netherlands, for example, there's great interest in using groundwater resources for heat storage, for heating and cooling. And perhaps that is synergistic with remediation of that groundwater. Surf Netherlands' goal is to facilitate a transition in the soil sector to a transparent way of working that's integrated with sustainability principles. They will be launching a position paper in November. Their view of sustainability is in common with the other initiatives, but there's a question of trying to find a net benefit in terms of indicators of PPP, and this is a different way of saying society, environment, and economy. This is people, profit, and planet. They will have their business plan ready by the end of the year, and I'm really delighted that this initiative has now taken off. The next slide, slide 70. Well, I won't spend too long on this because Dietmar has already presented you on the meeting, but the Common Forum on Contaminated Land in Europe is a network of agencies involved in regulation and policy to do with contaminated land from the different member states of the European Union. They are working on their own position paper, which Dietmar has mentioned to you, which is looking at the relationship between sustainability and remediation and this concept of risk-based land management to make a, well, what they call a fourth-generation concept. The idea is that there will be a draft available for discussion in the spring of next year. Next slide is slide 71, and this is LICOL. LICOL is the Network for Industrially Contaminated Land in Europe. This is a network of problem holders and service providers, with also some academic and regulatory people involved as well. They have a working group on sustainable remediation that's been working for several years now. At the beginning of the year, they published their framework or their vision, which is the sustainable remediation roadmap. That's available online. Coming soon on the website will be some more detailed supporting guidance with chapters on the linkage between risk assessment and sustainable remediation, and chapters on indicators and tools. Like SURF UK, Nicole's current focus now is on pilot testing this roadmap or framework and finding some case studies which it can then promote to the wider community in 2012. Nicole is very keen to collaborate and talk with the Common Forum and all of the other sustainable remediation networks that are taking place. And I think that Nicole wants me to emphasize to all of you who are listening now that Nicole is an open network if you'd like to join and participate with it. So, moving on now to the discussion, I shall hand over to Carlos. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thanks for the summaries and rounding up the updates. It's much appreciated. We have quite a few questions now that we'll be taking on the webinar, and it's I completely forgot to take phone questions, so I'm going to start with that right away. For those multitaskers, if you go to slide 73, as we take questions and have a discussion, you're free to browse through the additional resources. We try to pull all the links so that all the speakers presented into one page, and then any other information that they provided that was relevant to their presentation. And as always, if you complete the feedback form, that would be greatly appreciated. I'm going to start with a question that somebody asked when I was speaking at the beginning, and then I'll go to the end and work my way to the middle. This question is from John Munsel of Shenandoah, Texas. The question is, at some point will I talk about the expected dollar impact to a project of implementing the methodology? And it's or is this a future aspect that we'll consider? So, yes, internally we have looked at this. We completed approximately 18 full footprint evaluations as part of a series of pilot studies to produce the methodology. And toward the end, we were getting quite efficient at them, at least for average size remedies, and our estimate is that these were costing us from $5,000 to $15,000 for pretty much a full footprint, environmental footprint evaluation quantification. So it's not an insignificant amount of money, but in remedies that run into millions of dollars, the information they generate for us often leads to what are actually cost neutral or cost saving measures as part of the footprint, the remedy design and construction. An important note here is that the earlier we know about what footprint components we wish to address, the better it is. It's very expensive to switch out equipment that's already in the field, but if we're in the procurement phase for a contract for a consulting engineering firm for a remedy, and we ask, for example, like in Kira's case, that we want, low sulfur diesel with the right catalytic converters, et cetera, we can get that early on for a lot less money. So, Paul Nathaniel, I'm not sure if you are on the phone. Are you on the phone? No, he's not. He must be participating by the internet. He has a couple of announcements he wanted to add to Paul Bartos's list. The first is that Cabernet is running the next in a series of international conferences on sustainable land management in Katowice, Poland, on the 3rd of May of 2012. And further news from the UK is that the Department of the Environment, DEFRA, has received clearance to change the secondary legislation on contaminated land for England and the Welsh Assembly Government for Wales. The changes will, among other things, introduce a sustainability appraisal as part of the risk evaluation for very specific and limited set of circumstances. So let me stop a second here and see if there are any questions that folks hadn't had a chance to ask over the phone for any of the speakers. Okay, well, while you gather your thoughts, I'll continue with these that we have on the internet. So I'll take the next one. This is for Dietmar Mueller from Austria. The question is, again, from Diana from Langham Engineering in Warrenton, Pennsylvania. It's a two-part question. I'll ask you the first, let your answer, and then come back to the second. Her first part is related to the should we act, how do we act question of risk versus sustainability comparison. Suppose you have a site that is contaminated, but in the middle of nowhere, in parentheses, no risk to humans or the environment. Do you act on it or not from a sustainability perspective?
Well, my guess would be that the question to answer before still is there a risk? So, probably it would be Austrian manner to act even to sites which are in the middle of nowhere, but there are different cultures out there. So, usually the process would be logically, well, if there is no risk, well, it could stay.
Okay, I'll ask you the second part of the question, which is related. Is risk evaluation a precursor to the sustainability evaluation? Do you first have to determine if a site needs action and then decide how that action can be made in a sustainable way? Or can a sustainable action be a no action case?
Well, I would understand it isn't discussed within the common forum at that time that the risk assessment is the precursor for further action. Nevertheless, it could be as well taking kind of a decisions just that you want to reduce environmental impacts without any risks. So again, that would be kind of an Austrian manner, but I'm not sure that it would be in a similar way throughout to Europe.
Okay, thank you, Dietmar. I got a clarification from Paul Bartos. He's listening online. The date of the Cabernet conference is from the 3rd to the 6th of October 2012. Okay, let's see, next question. This is for Naomi. Naomi, this is from Dominique Dermondel in BRG in France. And the question is, scrolling here. Is National Grid the unique owner, a liable party, of the four sites of the Partington Cluster case study? If not, how did they manage the other owners / liable parties in terms of choice of levels of assessment, qualitative, semi-quantitative, quantitative, which impacted preferred options?
Okay. I suppose firstly, just as a reminder, it was a retrospective assessment for us to just look at once we'd finished the project and to carry out an assessment. So it was after we'd finished. But in terms of owners, yes, National Grid owned all four sites. And it's slightly complicated by the fact that National Grid Property owns and manages all of the surplus sites for the company. National Grid Gas, which is the regulated part of the business that manages the gas distribution, they own any operational land that may have been a former gas works in the past, but National Grid Property manage the environmental issues on their behalf. So even though it's one company, there is obviously the kind of complications of internal accounting issues. So there was both National Grid Property and National Grid Gas ownership, but it was obviously made easier by the fact that it was all National Grid. I suppose that said, the complications that we did have were the issues as a result of having four individual sites with four individual consultants who'd carried out the initial remediation designs on those sites, bringing those together, ensuring that the contracts meant that regardless of whether it was owned by a separate company to National Grid, that the contract facilitated the finances to be allocated to the right site. So I hope that answers the question.
I think so, and there's a related one, if I may.
Of course.
From a colleague of... Yes? Hello?
Hello, yeah, of course, Carlos. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, sorry. This is from Michael Gill, a colleague in our San Francisco office in California. The question is, can you give us any insight into why the local neighbors and businesses chose do nothing or no action as a preferred remedy for Site A when one could assume they would be the ones being impacted by contamination?
Yeah, okay. Again, I suppose one of the reason I didn't go into huge amounts of detail on this one is just because, it's a way of us being able to test it, and it was retrospective. We had to put ourselves in the position of the stakeholders in those cases, but the reason that we took the view that's the approach they would take is the two sites in question, or the one site in question, there were actually two, but one of them in particular was in an incredibly sensitive setting. It was bounded by houses on all sides, and had a primary school as well next door. And obviously there is the balance for neighbours of potentially increased land value if a site is developed, but there's also the concern over what that development might be, etc. So I think in terms of adjacent landowners, it's quite difficult to assess, but I think the view from the ones that we met were actually, it was quite difficult to get across the message that we had to do something, and I think there was quite a lot of concern about what that might lead to, which is, I think, the same for any remediation, and is the reason why close and early communication and engagement is important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Naomi. Kira, are you still here on the call, on the line?
Yes, I am.
Couple of questions for you. Regarding the Tacoma site, this is from Diane Essendon, again, Langham Engineering in Warrington, Pennsylvania. Regarding the Tacoma site, have the green metrics been tracked, computers reported for the site, and have they compared to the business-as-usual scenario? And we have a similar question from Paul Favara. Has an estimate of the footprint avoidance been completed to show the benefits of the greening process? Paul Ferrer was here in Hill in Gainesville, Florida.
We have not tried to go in and kind of quantitatively assess the reduction from the standpoint of how does this, how does it compare to business as usual? I mean, I guess the way that we view it is that a lot of the practices that we've implemented in regards to, for example, the examples of the excavation specifications, a lot of that stuff like specifying load, no idling and other things like that, they're really just best engineering practices. So I think some people, when you say, you know, compare it to business as usual, I think some people were already doing those things. I think we, within the environmental community, with it, at least with the way that we were contracting projects, we were just not necessarily looking at those, and making sure that we were specifying those types of things. So it would be hard to compare it and say, you know, well, what's considered business as usual? So we really haven't gone in to try to attempt and calculate what we've done and compare it to any other type of baseline, for example.
Okay, thank you, Kira. Again, for those on the phone lines, if there are any questions you wish to ask, please do so now. Step right in.
Yes, Carlos, this is Dave Woodward with AECOM. Could you ask Paul Bartos to provide contact information for Surf Netherlands, please?
Yeah, Paul, you go.
Sure, I can do that.
Thank you. And maybe what we can do, Paul, is also add it. I'm not sure if it's included in the slides. The person that provided you the information for each of the organizations, maybe it's let's add it after the we'll add it to the archives of the of the webinar. And also, Dave, if you look at the previous Consol webinars, members 1 and 2, we actually had representatives from all those organizations give a presentation. So anybody who's interested in a more expansive background on any of those efforts that Paul gave us an update on, if you go to one of the previous, I think it's Consol Webinar 1, you'll get a lot more detail as well as the points of contact. But thanks for the question.
Carlos, there's also information on those archives about initiatives in Australia and Canada, isn't there?
Correct. Thank you, Paul. Any other questions on the phones, please? Okay, I get a note here from listener Wayne Coutinho in Bloom, Mississauga, Canada, that for any Canadian audience listening, Surf Canada has recently launched in 2011. And their URL is www.surfcanada.org. So congratulations on that. Any other questions on the phone lines? Okay, well, I think I've gotten all my questions. I'm sorry, this refresh system in our chat page is not dropping some of the old questions, but I think that's got them all covered. Does anybody else, any of the speakers, wish to make any clarifying statements or with respect to any topic that's been discussed?
Carlos, there's a question on here for me on that slide 23 from Danielle Suzani and
okay.
Byron, and she said, why did you look at unit footprint rather than total? So I just wanted to explain that again because I think that's an important concept. For the Time Oil project, we had identified the main source area for the large dissolved phase plume, and basically it was the area that was defined as upgradient of the 300 ppb combined chlorinated hydrocarbon groundwater contour, and we, within the remediation plan, we had specified that our goal was to have a flux reduction down gradient of that contour of 90%. So up gradient of that, we had specified basically three remediation tools to try to achieve that flux reduction. One was excavation, one was in situ thermal, and one was enhanced anaerobic bioremediation. But what we also allowed ourselves to do was the flexibility to be able to modify how we mixed and matched the various the various remediation tools. So in looking at the consideration of how to optimize and combine and use each of those tools, we're able to look at what kind of combinations may have the least environmental footprint but still achieve the overarching remediation goal. So that's, I think, in projects where we've got kind of a multi-component design like that, that provides us an opportunity without changing the protectiveness of the goal to optimize how we combine technologies and consider the environmental footprint factor in that decision.
Great, thank you. Thanks, Kira. Thanks for stepping in. And Paul, you also had a clarification extension on Dietmar's answer. Prefer you give it verbally, then I try to interpret it for you. Are you still there?
No, I'm here. I think that what I wanted to add was that all of the networks working in Europe on sustainable remediation, this is in answer to a question from Diana, see that risk assessment is the precursor. Because if there's no risks from contamination, there's no need for contaminated land remediation in the first place. What is important, though, is that the risk assessment is appropriate and not unduly conservative. And that discussion is a little bit contentious in Europe at the moment.
Okay, thank you. So, Kira, is there any other question that, I'm having a bit of trouble with my refresh here. Anything else that has gone unanswered at this point?
It doesn't look like it. I think there was a question that I saw earlier that I don't think got answered, which was, but I can't remember who it was from, but it was a question regarding, for example, with the carbon, whether within EPA's methodology we go back and also consider kind of the environmental footprint associated with production of that carbon. And,
yes, good point.
And the answer to that is that no, we have decided not to go back to the footprint associated with primary production of materials or other things that are utilized. We're more looking at trying to assess the footprint of the actual action that we're taking in an attempt to kind of identify those pieces of the actions that we're implementing that can be modified to be less impactful on the environment.
Right, with the exception, though, of granular activated carbon, because that's, we did indeed, from the pump and treat systems that we analyzed, we did indeed find that in the case of gas, it does have a significant carbon footprint of its own. So what are the values of the methodologies that in those scenarios where we've had to research and go back and compute an embedded carbon footprint or water footprint or any other footprint of a material that we often use at site in large quantities that we see it's a recurring thing, item or material in the methodology itself, we have included those numbers, those derived numbers, and their sources. So thanks. I've seen that earlier, and it completely slipped my mind. So thanks for that, Kira. So any questions from the phone lines? Okay. Well, I think with that, we've concluded the presentation and the discussion. I thank all the speakers for taking the time to prepare for and participate in the webinar. For those of you on the internet, please remember to complete the feedback form at the end of the presentation. Of course, all our emails are available if you have any questions. And if you wish to share this with any colleagues, it will be archived, audio will be archived and available in a matter of about a week. So thanks to all participating on the phone lines and on the internet. We hope this was a productive investment of your time. Goodbye.